Delighted to have you in the podcast where all stories are welcome and the masks come off. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Sheba.
Welcome to Soul Brews with Sheba. I'm so delighted to have you on Coffee and Soul. Thank you so much for making the time, Kate.
And thank you so much for having me, Sheba.
It's a privilege, and I'm absolutely delighted to host you,
Kate. Yeah, my side too. A great privilege. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you have your cup of coffee ready with you?
I do have my cup of coffee ready with me.
Right. Yes. Good. Yeah. So I'm going to pour mine and... Ah, you know, the sound always does something.
It does.
Yes to life.
Okay. Yes to life. Yours is a long one, I see.
It is a long one, yeah.
For me, it's morning. So for me, it's a short, sharp one.
Yeah. Welcome. It's a delight to have you here. Cheers.
Ah. Mmm. What would life be without coffee?
Exactly. I wonder often. Kate, I'm going to ask you to just hold that cup of coffee in your hands, if you don't mind, and just nestle it between your palms. And can I ask you to just relax and sit back and breathe and be? Yeah, just relax. That's lovely. As you relax, see if there's anything that comes up for you in the form of a thought or a sound or a picture, anything that you view or hear or feel along with this warmth seeping in.
Well, Sheba, you won't be very surprised to hear that since I'm holding coffee, excuse me, and I'm also able to get the lovely aroma of the coffee, it's making me think of life before lockdown. And it's making me think it's just about a year, or maybe a little longer, even longer, since the last time I was in central London. I live a little outside London, and one of my main reasons for going to central London was actually to buy my coffee. There's a lovely old not sure if I'm able to advertise places on your podcast.
You can do anything you want.
Great. There's a wonderful place in Soho called the Algerian Coffee Shop. I don't know if it has anything to do with Algeria in its history, but it has the most lovely coffees, teas, coffee making equipment from all over the world. So it's a pleasure to go there in itself, but also it evokes something that is of a previous world. Something that's not possible now, and probably won't be possible in the same way for some time to come. I don't think that's a bad thing. It's just a memory. You know, the smells are often what evoke memories more than anything. And the smell of coffee, I had never thought of that until this morning.
Isn't that amazing? Well, what did that place mean for you? What did it signify, Kate? The Algerian coffee shop.
It was a lovely place in itself. It was such a great place to go to. And no place to sit and drink coffee there, but everyone just goes and gets their little cup while they're choosing their coffees, having a chat, having it packed up. So the experience was lovely in itself. I would make time to go deliberately there. But also it brings up how much the world has changed. In the last year, and we're all doing quite different things now, very different things.
Yeah. And just so keeping with this, what you're reflecting on, Kate, before the lockdown, with going through the pandemic and the lockdown, now going forward, but a lot before that as well. It'd be lovely to hear about your journey. And, you know, just your highs and lows, how life has been for you. And I'd love to hear your flow in life, with life, you know, some of your defining moments. And would love, I'm sure my viewers would also love to hear from you. So, yeah.
Well, I'm not sure how interesting it is, but it's always lovely to be able to speak about people's lives and their stories. And as a coach, I get to hear a lot. And then sometimes not to share a lot. So very happy to share with you,
lovely,
Shiva.
Lovely.
So I'm sitting here now in South London on the other side of a screen, speaking to you. And do you know, I don't even know that you exist. I have no tangible proof that you exist. You could be an avatar in a computer game. I don't think you are, but it's always possible. But here we are. Life gives us these possibilities. My story has not always been in South London. I've moved around a lot. And that's probably been a defining part of my life. I come, as I think we said before, I come from an Anglo-Indian family. Mm-hmm. And super proud of that, really super proud of that.
And you have every reason to be.
I have every reason to be. I'm super proud of my roots, yeah. I wish I could cook Anglo-Indian food better. I wish I could dance better. I wish I could sing better. And I wish I could tell better jokes, but I am super proud of the Anglo-Indian roots. My dad's family are from Mumbai. Mainly the boys would join what was then the Merchant Navy. The careers were generally doctors or engineers. Many of them were engineers. That was my dad's story. So my dad was at sea. Met my mum in a port city. Mm-hmm. Married my mum. I was born here.
And your mom is from London.
My mum is from the north of England. That's city called. It was a big port in those days. A port called Hull. I think it still is a fairly functional port. It's still known as a port city. And I think they also did some education programs there for the sea community. So my mum and dad went there. My dad wanted to be a doctor. He couldn't be a doctor. So when he left the Navy, the next best thing, he joined the National Health Service and had a career initially in engineering and then into management from there. And he spent most of his career in there.
Well, that's so interesting. Right. Yeah.
I do remember the time I first became really aware of my Anglo-Indian roots. And that was also the time that I became aware of the big themes of today around diversity, inclusion, racism, anti-racism. Because I remember at that time, I'm giving my age away here, it was back in the 60s, maybe early 70s. And at that time, there was a lot of immigration. And when you get immigration, you get attitudes. Yeah. And one of the attitudes was these people are coming in and taking the jobs and, you know, what have you. And it's not very nice. It's not very nice. I had never thought of that before, but I remember one day I came home from school. I was about 7 years old, and my mum said to me, if anyone asks where your dad comes from, tell them you think he's from Greece or somewhere. I had no idea where Greece was and no idea where somewhere was. But I remember thinking, oh, okay, something here is different. This is why we go to my auntie's house every Sunday afternoon and play guitars and dance. And then, so I started to then associate a lifestyle and a set of values with cultural heritage.
Yeah.
And it changed at that point. It changed at that point because I was always thinking, right, so I don't quite feel a fit here. What do I do? Where do I move to? And I studied languages at school and at university. I actually studied French and Italian at university, put my French and Italian to very good use by going immediately to Japan as soon as I graduated. And I got into the then very new field called teaching English as a foreign language. It was super new. I think I was probably one of the early cohorts to start to qualify in that. Okay. In that area, I did my a certificate, then a degree, and then my first master's I did in linguistics and cross-cultural stuff.
So this cross-cultural stuff, tell me more about it. Obviously, the roots are at what you just said. You ascribe them perhaps to the fact that, you know, different cultures are a part of your life, right, from the very, very early on. So is that something that you see as a theme going through your life?
It's very much, it's bordering on a passion. I'm not a super passionate person, but it's bordering on a passion. If I had a passion, this would be it. And I got interested in it from the intellectual perspective when I was working in Hong Kong and I was working in City University. And we had a department that was, of course, it was very multicultural, very multilingual. And I noticed that in our department, we were the Department of Languages and Communications, and we functioned quite well. We got on with each other well. And I noticed in other departments there were some tensions and disagreements, unproductive disagreements. And I began to think, I wonder if this has got something to do with our background. And being more multilingual, multicultural, I wonder if this gives us a skill set that enables us to be more productive together. So that's where I started, probably more of a PhD thesis than a master's thesis. So I had to narrow it down. I did have to narrow it down. But I needed a topic for my master's thesis. So I went into the then quite new cultural anthropology and social psychology around the cross-cultural stuff. And it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating. So I was able to run a survey within my department that I was young at the time. I was young at the time, so I didn't know what I was taking on. But I was able to run a survey and then come up with some stuff that did support the hypothesis that people who were coming from multicultural backgrounds and also had at their command more than one language seemed to be able to work more creatively and productively together. So
that was really early on. You came up with something like this.
I took it into my work then. I did take it into my work. We did, not long after that, I was working for a service strategy consulting firm. That it was Asia-based and we worked all over Asia. We had some lovely projects. For example, one was about hiring airline crews to staff a particular airline that was flying international routes. And of course, in that service environment, you have passengers, customers from all over the world. Mm. And people have quite different service expectations based on the human side of it, as well as the standards side of it. And we wanted to create airline crews who could really work to very high standards. We had Japan as one of our markets, so there we had super high service, service standards, but also work to, you know, work to the heart as well, because that's why passengers would fly an airline. That's often why people are often quite loyal, even to their national airline, even if it's not very good. I speak from experience. But people are quite loyal. It's not just the points; it's the experience. So I used it. We designed a program there called Soul of Asia. We started with Heart of Asia, but then we went to Soul of Asia.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. We ran it for airlines, some hotel groups at that time, and now when I sometimes see the training in those hotels, and I still see parts of that program alive and well, of course, adapted.
Really?
What's happening there? Yeah, alive and well.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. So there's a legacy there. Obviously, it worked really well, and people have worked on it, tweaked it, and are continuing with that. It's amazing.
I hadn't thought about that before I started talking to you. Yeah.
Great. Okay. And then after that,
Let me take a sip of coffee. So after that, yeah, I couldn't put it down, you know. So after that, I decided that I had become quite good in all this stuff around training and process consulting, but I was really feeling the need for something real and solid, like an MBA. So I did that. I got a place at London Business School, which was great. And again, I was faced with writing a dissertation for my MBA thesis, and I did the same thing. I decided I would go back into that kind of area, but the tack I took on it was about learning rather than service or service delivery. So what was the relationship between culture and learning? So in my first master's, I'd look at,
That's all right. That's all right. It's not part of life. It's all right.
Yeah. It's like issue, but it's actually from you. So you're disturbing me.
I'm disturbing you. I plead guilty.
And WhatsApp is delivering a little bit late. So here's an interesting thing as well. So I had my first dissertation had taken me to the areas of the cross-cultural lenses for mapping cultures. So in those days, it was Geert Hofstede, it was Frans Trompenaars, it was Hampton Turner, and of course there are many others who have entered the field now. Erin Meyer is one of my favorites. But I had worked on the frameworks, and I was wondering, so if someone wants to develop a greater cross-cultural capability or a greater cultural intelligence, well, how do you do that? And I was fortunate at that time to have at London Business School a colleague, Chris Early, who'd been working with Sun Ang in Singapore on precisely this. It's how do you assess an individual for cultural intelligence? How do you develop cultural intelligence in someone? And I thought, yes, we bring these two things together. And now there's actually a certification, there's a coach certification that we can do in that. It's David Livermore in the US. Gosh, I'm advertising a lot of people's products here, aren't I? But he has made it accessible to a lot of coaches. It changed a little, but made accessible. I haven't done that because I tend to work with the framework in my head, rather than via the tool.
So there's a question that's coming up for me as you say this, Kate, and if you could, haven't thought about that, and tell me, is this interpersonal and intrapersonal intelligence, would that be an important facet of cultural intelligence?
In that, one of the so one of the facets of cultural intelligence would be that facet of learning to learn.
Learning how to learn, yeah.
And someone who has interpersonal intelligence is able to pick up signals from the environments, the quite novel environments that we would find ourselves in, and figure it out. So what's going on here? And then how do I need to be in that environment? So in that sense, yes, it links very much. It also links to, you know, if we think about the people that we know, Sheba, with what we would call an interpersonal intelligence, they're probably quite good at things like empathy. They're probably quite good at mirroring the other person, and that would be the skill part of cultural intelligence. So definitely there's a link there.
Okay, right.
The other part is motivation. So some people are they don't feel capable, or they don't feel motivated to learn, and that's fine. So one of the things that that a cultural intelligence approach more broadly will ask is, okay, what are you doing here? What's your job? Are you facilitating some Zoom meetings with people from different parts of the world? What's their experience? Are they sort of multicultural folks themselves? Is it a multinational organization you're working with? Right, the other end of the scope, which is, do you really want to, you know, how far do you want to really feel and be felt of, felt as belonging to that culture, a native of that culture? I heard it described to me in a rather nice way, which is, do you want to be able to order local food in Spain, or do you want to be Spanish? Because on the one hand, you just go for a Spanish phrase book, and on the other hand, you better go and live for 4 years and learn the Spanish guitar and really get into the sort of culture. So it's got a lot to do with the motivation of the person, which again will, you know, when we're learning any skills, we hit roadblocks.
Fascinating. Yeah. That's fascinating. And I see that, you know, the differentiator, as you say, and I mean, and it makes a lot of sense, Kate, on something that would be surface and something that would really mean getting into the skin of the,
And imagine Sheba, if you really wanted to belong and to be seen as belonging, if you got it wrong, you would feel it. And that feeling would be, okay, I feel bad for a moment, but hey, what can I learn from this? And you really push, you really persevere. So imagine if you're even just trying to learn a language under those circumstances, you stick at it. Whereas if you're not really very bothered, you might make a mistake here and there, but you might not be motivated to push through, to persevere. And either way it can be okay, but it's important that we know ourselves
absolutely
how far we want to go. And if we're learning in a class, it's really important that we know I'm different and you're different to you, and you're different in your motivations. Otherwise we tend to measure ourselves towards other people's standards, and that doesn't, certainly in this kind of thing, that doesn't work.
Yeah. It's fascinating what you're saying, and also you know, opens doors into deeper thinking on this, and I think that's required, particularly in the world that we live in today. Kate, how did coaching find you? Or how did you find coaching?
I think we found each other. And it was a life thing, Sheba. So I had, I'd be doing a busy job. I'd been doing a busy consulting job.
And this was after your MBA?
This was after my MBA. So then after my MBA, I joined London Business School's Executive Education on the consulting side. So the putting together of programs, the working with clients, the design before it's over, that kind of thing. And it was quite demanding, required a lot of travel. And it was simply at that point, I had a young child, I had elderly parents. And while my child was getting older, so were my parents. And that kind of the lifestyle was absolutely not sustainable. So I began to think, okay, and oh, also I wasn't getting any younger myself. I have to put that in. So I began to think quite practically of work that rewards wisdom and doesn't punish age. And coaching comes into that category. And actually, when I first trained in coaching, I wasn't sure. I absolutely wasn't sure. So I'm going to advertise another company now at this point. I chose a coaching course which was very much based around the idea that we, the coach, are the tool. And I looked at what their 20-day program was about. And when I looked at it, I thought, well, I'm not sure if I can do this, and I'm not sure if I want to do this, but my goodness, it's going to be fantastic personal development, whether I do anything with it or not. Mm. So I did my 20 days. I decided, yep, I can do this. And I decided, yep, I want to do this, or at least make it a part of how I manage the portfolio of my ongoing life. And here we are. It's really been a journey of discovery since then. And I have been very fortunate, very blessed in that coaching has found me and clients have found me. And I've been able to interpret what I do according to client environment and client need.
I can imagine. What's it that you... Firstly, I just want to congratulate you on that beautiful sentence. It's really left a mark on me, which is something that doesn't punish age and rewards wisdom. And that is equal to coaching. I think that's a beautiful way to look at it. And it's very powerful. So I just wanted to underline that to say thank you for sharing that. It's really...
I'm probably saying a lot of things that are not really very politically correct in this podcast.
No, there is the bit about this podcast is you just have to be yourself. That's it.
But the masks come off. Yeah.
Well, I hope. Yeah. So all right. And so and coaching has been an enjoyable journey for you thus far.
Very much. Like a lot of coaches. I learn as much from my clients as they learn from me. It's very rewarding when I find working with someone very rewarding when then they take that out to their own teams, out to their own organizations, out to their own families well. Mm. And it's nice to feel that kind of, it's not a massive impact, but it's nice to feel the ripples.
Exactly, it's the ripples, right? And that is pretty massive when it ripples out. It doesn't seem very much, but my God, what an impact it does have. So, as we talk about your journey, what have been some of the key influences in your life, Kate? What are there people or moments that stand out? Or?
I think. Moments. So my first one was my seven-year-old self suddenly discovering I'm Anglo-Indian, that's cool. That was another one. That was one. I think another one was my first leadership experience, first real leadership experience. I was young again, probably about 24 years old. And it was at the time when there was quite a massive movement of Indo-Chinese, mainly Vietnamese refugees, into Hong Kong. And I worked then in a UNHCR transit center where we were preparing people to go off to US, UK and Australia. So there was a language and there was a cross-cultural program. And, being able to start my career, not exactly start, I'd been in Japan for a few years before then, but still at a young age, designing, teaching, and making supporting learning in that kind of environment, it grounds you.
Yeah,
it really grounds you. I mean, people need skills because they've got lives to rebuild. So if you you've lost almost everything, you've had some gold, you've given it to someone to put you and your family on a small boat, ready for a new life. You may be super educated professional. You may be, you may not have education. You may speak some of the language of the country you're going to, you may not. But still, you need to go and you need to build a new life. And so what it taught me is to go from the rational to the emotional in the learning.
How was that journey?
I was young and it was, I think it stayed with me because I know it sounds obvious now, but at that age, I think I was designing a rational program of, okay, you're going to need the skills for buying food, cooking food and eating food in this new environment. You're going to need the skills for getting a new job. But it doesn't stick unless you're starting with thinking about how the person thinks about themselves in this situation. And this is across two languages this was Vietnamese. I knew very little Vietnamese other than the Vietnamese language classes that we were having in the transit center. But it taught me that for someone to learn a skill like that, and to really learn it and to really use it, you have to start with how they think about themselves. And I applied that in a new environment when we were doing the training for the airline crews as well. Because, if you're delivering service to someone, it's a very personal relationship.
Yeah.
And we all default. We actually default to how we deliver service in our homes. So someone comes in.
It's very powerful. Yeah.
Really. I mean, you think about if someone comes into your home, you think about how you address them. Are they going to be an auntie and an uncle or are they not? Are you going to make sure they eat before they leave or are you not? Are you going to offer them something or are you going to give them something without the offer of choice? All these things are very embedded in the way we are. And if I bring you into my environment and ask you to execute a service procedure that to you doesn't feel like you're looking after these people, that's going to be very difficult for you to do. And actually, my service procedure probably won't land with the people maybe of your culture who you know much better than I do. So let's have a conversation around what actually the guest host relationship looks like and what makes both of us most comfortable and most well served in that environment, and then we can build we can flex and adapt so that you feel pride in what you give and your customer, your passenger, your guest feels care in what they receive.
Yeah. And so making the experience translatable into actual life is and into the experience for the other person, which is absolutely. And so then this was one key influence in your life. What else? Was there anything else that, or any other moments that you can think of? Or?
I think the pandemic.
We can't escape that one, can we?
We can't. No. Yeah, so I've probably done more change in this last year of my life, been more real questioning of myself in this last year of life, more real questioning of what's possible and what's not possible in this last year of life than I had in the, I don't know, previous 10 years altogether. And I'll give you one example of that, Sheba. I remember the first ever virtual training that I did, apart from, you know, these kinds of conversations we've been doing in coaching for some time. Sure. So although even in the coaching days, early coaching days, do you remember coaching over Zoom? Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
We're frozen. I mean, it was painful, wasn't it?
It was painful.
We learned, you know, all the platforms, they've really upped their game. And we know how to flip from one to the other and to spot our phones, etc. So for you and I to have this conversation, we don't have to think about the tech. So that's obviously one difference. But I remember also in the learning to design and then learning to facilitate online. I remember, again, about this time last year, a client who trusted a team of us said, well, you can't come to Amsterdam, obviously, because we're locked down. So do you want to try virtual? And we said, yes. We had no idea what we were getting ourselves into. But hey, you know, we went into it and we had to learn the platform from start. But I remember reading an article that said, okay, when it comes to training, you can do content online, easy, but you can't do the socio-emotional online. And I thought, oh no, what have I let myself into? Because the whole of this program, it was interpersonal. It was all socio-emotional. There was very little content.
Mm.
So I thought, okay, is it too late to change our minds? Yeah, so let's just go for it. So what we did is we did some things to make it safe. So, you know, if you're facilitating on site with a group of people, you can take people to really the edge of their comfort zones, and you can catch it if things go further than you think.
Yeah.
You've got the space, you can catch people. You're going to see them at lunch, you're going to see them at dinner, etc. Virtual, people just flip off their screens and you don't know what they're going into. You don't know what they've come from, you don't know what they're going into.
I remember a conversation we had on that one, and you had shared something as well. You know,
yes.
The screen just went blank. Yeah, go ahead, Kate. Yeah.
Yes, we did. I remember that too. Yes. And, you know, we really don't know what's what happens there. So what we did in this, my first ever program, is we said, okay, we'll play it safe. All the exercises we'll do, we'll make them contained so we can always predict three or four outcomes, and then we know we can contain them. So we really, really played safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end, we thought, okay, so what do we do to wrap up the program? And you know, when you're facilitating, we usually end with maybe everybody making a commitment or something like that, you know, some kind of closure. So we decided that for the closure, we would have everybody giving each other a virtual gift.
Okay.
So it was rather like, I don't know, are you familiar with a Secret Santa?
Yes, a mystery buddy, yeah.
That's right, that kind of thing. Yeah. One of my colleagues was very good at understanding the dynamics with the group. So, you know, Kate would give to Shiba, Shiba would give to Manbir, Manbir would give to da-da-da-da. So, you know, at least we were giving to people that we had experience with. So we asked them to do that. We gave them 10 minutes to go off. It was deep lockdown. So it was literally go into your house, or if you're lucky enough to have a garden, go there, bring something, and that will be your gift to the next person
that's beautiful,
it's a gift going forward, so to encourage them on their journey. And the gift people got for each other were amazing. The insight that they had shown And these were people who had met each other only two-dimensionally online. Amazing. And they had spent, people were moving around in groups, but I think they had spent probably a maximum of 10 hours in the company of that person. And amazing. In that time, they were able to discern the essence of that person and what to give them, what to give them as a gift going forward. It was...
What a wonderful creature the human being is, isn't it?
It's... I know. So the idea that you can't do socio-emotional online, and I know many people have since discovered this. This isn't a massive discovery, but many people have said the same thing. But that was a big influential moment for me online.
Sure. Yeah, and it really must have moved the needle in terms of what you could offer, and it would go down well, and the confidence of, yes, it can happen.
Absolutely. And you know, when you say that, Sheba, I think a lot of people have benefited from that, because there was a moment when some of my clients, at least, I don't know about yours, were quite nervous of virtual and almost stopped. And it was wonderful to be able to say, no, I've experienced this. It works. We can do that. And to offer that personal reassurance that we've done it. These were the scores. This was the feedback. It wasn't just us that were saying it was good. We had feedback to show, yes, this works.
And that's fantastic.
Since the pandemic, let's do it anyway. And it's probably quite supportive for people.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. It would be, right? Because then they can fall back on it and say, okay, let's give it a shot and let's work with
Let's give it a shot and we learn a lot. And we get together in really helpful ways. Yeah. And of course, with a pandemic, for some people, their jobs, they're parts of the jobs that they can't do. So they do have a bit of spare time. Mm-hmm. And what better way of using that time than to invest in your learning?
Absolutely. And Kate, just moving forward on this conversation, that's wonderful what you've just shared. And in terms for people to also understand where how quickly we can adapt to a completely different, a completely new environment, and give people the kind of experience that kind of moves them away from feeling isolated to being connected again in another way. Just moving this forward, is there, when the chips are down or things are not going really well, is there a fallback metaphor you have, or an adage that you live by?
Oof.
Or many, maybe a few. I mean, that's whatever that comes up.
Yeah. The one that comes to mind often is it's attributed to Einstein, and I'm not even sure in fact, I think it probably isn't, but it's that one about you can't solve a problem from the same level of thinking that created it.
So you've got to go either a level deeper or a level higher.
Exactly. Yeah, you have to go down or up. And I think that's very powerful. I love the way you did that, Sheba, a level deeper. And often, sometimes you need to go sort of up into the system and think about the systemic influences. And sometimes you need to go down deep into the body and the wisdom of the body. So it's up and deep, but it's very rarely at the same level. It is very rarely at the same level that we created it, because that keeps us in the same kind of cognitive loop.
Absolutely. Yes. And in terms of when you're looking at people, Kate, who are just starting out in their lives right now, and probably a younger Kate or someone on a similar kind of a journey, or people that you see, is there a message that you have for them? Is there something that you'd tell them from where you are today to, say, 20 years before?
Well, thinking about the young people that I know, this is going to sound very much like an old person speaking to a young person, but it's a do it now message. If there's something, it's an impulse that's saying, this is what I want to do. This is what I feel called to do. This is what, just do it now. Do it now. Don't put it off. Do it now.
I think that's a very powerful gift, because it's so easy to say, I'll do this tomorrow, or is it good, or is it, and wait to ratify it. And what I'm hearing you say is that, and tell me if I'm, is that don't wait to get it validated. If it's a strong impulse, just do it. Am I correct in that understanding?
Yes, I think so, yes. And in, you know, in doing things, we get some movement, and then we start to learn. I don't want to make it sound like a very sort of action-orientated kind of doing. Sometimes stand back, reflect, be patient, wait is really important. But I'm talking about this kind of hesitation. Hesitation is probably not helpful. If you're hesitating, just do it. If it's meant to be stopped and reflected on, then do that. But the hesitation takes time, energy, and it's not helpful.
Great. Thank you. I think that's a very strong message, and it's hugely helpful for people to kind of not just walk on two logs, but just, you know, take the leap.
Is that your metaphor, Shiva? Two logs.
Something like that.
I like that one. Can I have it?
Please. Kate, I believe every individual, each one of us has a unique gift to offer to people, to humankind. What is yours? Something that only you do, that no one else mm-hmm. does. And it's true. It's true.
I'm not sure I'm unique, because the population of the world is very large. I'm not sure I'm unique, but I think we can all be unique in the various situations that we find ourselves in, that we show up in. And so I find it quite hard to take life very, very seriously. And as you
know, thank God for that.
And I've got a strong streak of rebellion. So I like to challenge situations when they don't make sense.
And that's a strength. That's a real strength. And is that something that you find that kind of influences the outcome, because people haven't looked at it in a particular manner? And when you bring that up, it probably does a little bit of disruption, which is required. Do you see that happening, Kate?
It's often voicing things that people are thinking, but for some reason, you know, people have lives to take care of as well. People have their mortgages to pay. People have their reputations to take care of, and sometimes we don't say stuff. So it's quite nice when someone who's a bit older just comes and says it. So it's often voicing something that's in the room.
Yeah, and that is a gift. That is a real gift to be able to do that, so that everybody kind of breathes after that to say, oh my God, thank God, I didn't say it, she did, so but it's out there. So. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Kate? What else?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Shiva. It's not often we have the opportunity to just to chat over coffee. I've noticed you haven't been drinking your coffee, so I hope it hasn't gone cold.
I've been drinking some off and on. Thank you so much for this wonderful conversation and for the openness, Kate, and also for reflecting on your life and how it's been, and particularly all the things you brought about. I hope you continue to voice out the things that people don't find it easy to voice, and therefore make it easier for all of us to walk a different path. And thank you so much for making the time. It's been an absolute delight to speak with you.
Thank you so much for having me, Shiva. The pleasure is mine, and it should be me thanking you for your time. And I hope you will continue with this podcast and speaking to your fantastic guests. I love to listen. It's a delight.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much. And you take care, Kate.
You take care too.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for your time and attention and for being a part of Soul Brews with Shiva. Until next week, keep the coffee swirling.